We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580, FM 90.9, HD2, and online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in today. Late in 2005, the New York Times was first to report that the National Security Administration was monitoring international phone calls and email messages without warrants. Late last year, we heard reports of the government monitoring Facebook, Twitter, and other social networking sites. Do we have a right to privacy, given that we so freely exchange personal information in the digital world? Can we protect our privacy? This afternoon, we're going to take a look at privacy with author and attorney Frederick S. Lane. He is the author most recently of American Privacy, the 400-year history of our most contested right. Listeners, join our discussion with your thoughts today. I look forward to your questions and comments. Join us with a phone call or by email. The phone number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. The toll-free number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Our email address is will-talk@illinois.edu, WILL-talk@illinois.edu. Frederick Lane is an author, attorney, expert witness, and lecturer. He is a graduate of Amherst College and Boston College Law School. He's the author of four previous books on how legal issues, affect society. His latest, American Privacy, is published by the Beacon Press. 333-9455, 800-222-9455, and will-talk@illinois.edu. Frederick Lane, thank you so much for talking with us this afternoon.
You're most welcome, Fluff. Thank you for having me on.
Sure. You tell an amazing story at the close of American Privacy. It involves iTunes and an app that allows you to share your music library with other iTunes users on a Wi-Fi network. Would you share that story with our listeners?
Sure, I'd be happy to. It's actually a pre-iPhone story, so it's not even so much an app, but actually a function of the iTunes software itself. Basically, the story involved a bit of research and writing that I was doing at a cafe in New Haven. And I, as you say, was at the tail end of putting together this book on privacy. And many of your listeners may know that when you fire up your iTunes and you're on a public network, as I was in the cafe, iTunes will show you the names of other music libraries that are on that same Wi-Fi network. And many people will use some kind of fictional name, or they'll have the name of their computer, which is relatively anonymous. But not infrequently, people will also just allow iTunes to use their actual name as the name of their music library. So as I'm sitting in this coffee shop, there were three or four names that popped up in my iTunes. And simply as an experiment, I wanted to see whether or not I could identify one of the people whose iTunes account was broadcasting their name. So I took at random one of the names from my in the iTunes listing, and I put it into Google. And it took me about 2.5 minutes to find a photo that matched the individual in the cafe whose, you know, iTunes account was broadcasting. And along with that, of course, I got a pile of private information about that individual, or information that maybe is not necessarily private per se, and we'll have to discuss what that means.
Mm-hmm.
But when taken in combination, could create the illusion of familiarity with that person where none was intended. I mean, just the iTunes account alone, I could see what were the last dozen albums that she had purchased from iTunes, a breakdown of the music that she enjoyed most. But then beyond that, once you get into Google, it was relatively easy to find the house at Yale that she lived in, what her major was. I got a couple of high school papers that teachers had put online. I found out that she was an equestrian and had done reasonably well in her last meet. Her grandfather had recently died, which meant now that I knew her hometown and so forth. It was really quite startling how fast that could happen.
Yeah, that's really, to me, that's frightening.
Well, I think what's frightening about it, and I think that this is really where the thrust of this book is intended to go, is that it bespeaks a lack of control that we have over the information that we generate. And that, to me, is really the essence of the right to privacy. The right to privacy is not so much that certain areas of our lives are categorically private, as we think of that, and not available to others, as Facebook and MySpace and Twitter and all of the rest of that demonstrate. We can certainly choose to put whatever aspects of our lives out into the world that we want. But what the right to privacy really speaks to is the ability to control how far that information should spread. And that's where I think we have some real problems, but at the same time, some real potential for effective legislation.
Yeah. Now, recently in a commentary that we have on our radio station every week called Legal Issues in the News, Our commentator Amy Guida said this: as long as we regard privacy as an important part of life, the law will be responsive. So if we're cavalier with information about ourselves, what do we risk?
We risk a bunch of different things, I think. And I think that's a very germane question, because honestly, you know, there are plenty of people out there who, you know, endorse the idea that John Major introduced when he was running for prime minister in the mid-1980s, which is that if you've got nothing to hide, you've got nothing to fear. That, I think, is rather glib, because, among other things, of course, John Major used it as an excuse to make Britain the most surveilled country in Western Europe. So I think that can go too far. But what we really need to do to help people understand what the concerns can be is to look at two things. First of all, we need to look at our country's own political history, because you really don't have to go back very far to find instances in which governmentally collected information was being misused. And of course, the best example is the Nixon administration, where the Nixon administration was using both the FBI and the military to conduct surveillance on American citizens who were then subjected to harassing audits by the IRS, who lost jobs, who were denied federal scholarships, federal benefits of one kind or another. In those instances, it was very clear that information collected by the government was being misused for political purposes. Go back a little bit further, and you've got the McCarthy era, where, again, the FBI was involved because warrantless wiretapping was, you know, perfectly legal under Supreme Court doctrine at that point. And huge amounts of information was being collected about people in this rampant effort to determine whether or not they were communists. So people do need to remember that even a government acting with the best intentions can misuse, and sometimes affirmatively will misuse, that information in ways that are not legal or constitutional. The other issue that I think people do need to start paying more attention to is the vast amount of information that's being collected by corporations and the implications that that has for us both as consumers and as citizens. And I think from a consumer point of view, the obvious risk is that we will, in a sense, be shoeboxed or buttonholed in various ways based on our prior activity. And the choices that we might otherwise have in a free and open market will somehow be narrowed because, based on our profile, we don't want those quote-unquote choices. And I think that that's sort of maybe a theoretical harm, but it's, I think, a potentially real one. And I also think that it is a risk that we've seen flashes of with respect to people in various areas being denied mortgages because maybe the area isn't safe or because it's disproportionately minority or what have you. So, again, we need to be very conscious of how information is being collected and how it's being used.
Yeah.
And there's a synergy, and this is the last quick point I'll make, there's a synergy between governmental surveillance and corporate surveillance under the Patriot Act, in the sense that the FBI, when it's conducting national security investigations, now has tools to collect much more information from private databases than it did before. So we're starting to see a blurring of these two areas, and that, I think, is an even greater concern.
I've got a caller who's waiting to talk with us, and I want to get to this individual shortly, but I do want to ask this big, broad question that I think would be useful in our discussion. When we talk about privacy, what are we talking about? What is privacy?
Well, it's a very big and broad question. I think that if we start from the constitutional perspective, which is, you know, ultimately where my book begins, and it actually predates it a little bit, but the core of our understanding of privacy comes from the Bill of Rights. And this is where I derive this idea that privacy is about choice and about the control of information more than it is about a, if you will, a specific state of information or a state of being. If you look at the Bill of Rights, and this is what the Supreme Court did in the 1960s, all of the various amendments to one degree or another were adopted as a way of giving the colonists more control over their relationship with the government. Now, at the time, of course, businesses were not big enough to really attract the attention of the framers, but government certainly had been in the body of the king. So they were very concerned about the extent to which we could protect our ability to choose how invasive government could be. That is to say, what the government could do to limit our free speech choices, who we associate with, what religion we believe in, whether or not we have to house troops except in times of war, whether we can self-incriminate ourselves. All of these things, when you look at their core value, is really about the issue of control and choice. And so that, I think, is ultimately what the right of privacy is intended to protect, not whether or not you're wearing purple socks and you want to announce that on Facebook. That's entirely up to you, but that's a choice you get to make.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Frederick Lane, his most recent book, American Privacy, the 400-year history of our most contested right. Privacy is our topic here this afternoon on the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us with a phone call this afternoon or an email, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, toll-free 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu, will-talk@illinois.edu. Let's take a call now from a listener in Chicago on line 4. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Good topic. I don't think there's any place right now, at least in the United States, that you're safe from not being listened to. I mean, I think your privacy, you guys are talking about privacy. It seems like everybody wants your privacy. Like behind closed doors, I don't even think there's no such thing. If you go on your daily basis, your daily rounds from, I don't know about you guys down there, but I know up here in this neck of the woods, you got cameras everywhere. You got listening devices everywhere. You got Uncle Sam wanting 24/7 information from you. And it's just like you said, the internet. And my concern, and it's to me, is security, not only for electing people, but just for being struck again, is that I think there are ways that the enemy gets to us through the internet. I mean, it's almost been proven a couple of times, and there's been articles written about it, but at the same time, I don't trust the election machines. For instance, I had vote this afternoon, and my machine was messed up. It didn't allow me to, you know, it only allowed me to vote for one person, and it didn't allow me to vote for, you know, at least a dozen others. And this has happened to me time and time again, and it's a problem that's been happening here, in at least where I'm at, in Chicago and surrounding areas, the suburbs. And what my biggest fear is that we're electing people fraudulently, because of, you know, who hackers. Hackers can come in and hack the system. I don't know about you, but I think the information technology age has kind of killed us in a way. And I'm kind of just curious how you feel about it. I mean, to me, the biggest thing I have going right now is that I fear about is security of this country, and I think we've lost it. Thanks. I'll get off and listen.
Okay. Frederick Lane, where do you want to begin?
Well, there are a number of good points in the caller's call. I think that, well, let's start at the very end, and maybe we can work our way backwards as we have time. But, you know, certainly the issue of privacy versus security is at the core of our current debate right now. If you take a look at the urgency with which the Patriot Act was passed, it was a multi-100-page bill that was signed into law 45 days after 9/11. So, you know, we can assume, I think, that it probably didn't get as thoroughly vetted as it might have in that process. As somebody commented to me the other day, oftentimes our legislation needs as much of a full-body scan as we do, and the Patriot Act, I think, was a good example of that. We are always wrestling with that dynamic between how much security do we want and how much privacy are we willing to give up for it. And there's no easy answer to that. I think that where you come down on that question, I think, has a lot to do with your fundamental political beliefs, and that's understandable. I do think that most of us would agree, though, that if we don't pay attention to how invasive the government can be, and, you know, certainly the NSA surveillance of the AT&T lines is a worrisome thing, then we really run the risk of giving up exactly what it is that we claim is important about our system, which is the constitutional protections that we have. That, I think, does tie in to some degree with what the caller was asking about elections, because obviously, we have an Australian ballot system for most of our elections in this country, and if we don't have confidence that those votes that we cast are private and confidential, at least vis-a-vis the other people around us, then the credibility of the system as a whole gets undercut, and you have people really questioning the legitimacy of people who get elected. Up here in Vermont, which is where I am, we use the Scanatron or Omnitron ballots, which are actual paper ballots that you mark and then feed through a reader. And I have to say that that is a system which is much more comforting in a sense in terms of the ultimate credibility of the outcome, because if there's a dispute, you can literally look at the ballot and determine whether or not someone has, you know, intended to do something, and it's not tied to a particular individual. I have grave concerns, as much as I'm a technology buff, I have grave concerns about electronic voting. I would say overall that one of the things that is a little bit ironic about American privacy is that I think part of the solution for these issues that we're all concerned about lies in actually a little bit more government, not a little bit less. And the analogy that I make in the conclusion is that at some point in our history, we realized that the environment was one of those issues that was so big that we needed some kind of organization to work on behalf of citizens and consumers to protect it. And so we passed the Environmental Protection Agency. We did the same thing with food and drugs when we passed the FDA. There's a bunch of other examples along those lines. And I think privacy is basically an environmental issue for society, if you will. It really has a pervasive effect on our relationship with government and on our relationship with corporations. And it's not something that it feels to me like an individual can effectively protect themselves these days. And I do think that there would be a lot of benefit to having trained professionals who could help set standards for how both government and corporations interact with people and what they do with the information that they collect.
Now, we've got another caller here who's waiting for us, but before we get to that call, I want to follow up here quickly. Given the government attacks on privacy that you mentioned earlier, do you want the government to be protecting privacy?
It's an obvious question. My response would be that it seems to me that if we look back over the history of the Environmental Protection Agency, the Food and Drug Administration, and so on and so forth, you can see clear examples where those agencies have put a stop to government practices that were damaging whatever it was that was within their jurisdiction. And so it seems to me that we do have a model where that can work. And certainly, I think when you take a look at those organizations that are in place now, having a group of trained professionals in a particular area that is responsible for protecting citizens and protecting society as a whole makes them a watchdog that in turn can be closely watched by outside groups that care a great deal about this. And I think that you end up getting some very effective partnerships, for instance, between the Sierra Club and the EPA or Greenpeace and the EPA. Sometimes they're at odds, but oftentimes they work together. And it just, I think, makes the whole concept of supervision much more effective and hopefully much more responsive to individual concerns than the government is right now. I'm not saying that this would solve every issue that we have, because obviously, unlike the environment, by and large, and unlike Food and Drug Administration, we don't have national security issues as much as we do in the privacy realm. So it would be harder, but I think we could definitely make a good start.
Let's take another couple of calls now. Urbana, line one, hi.
Yeah, good afternoon.
Sure.
I was just, your conversation made me think about the situation where sometimes the public has to request information from the government through a Freedom of Information Act, because the government or whatever body, you know, is able to kind of stonewall and hold, you know, what you would think would be public information and keep it away from the public. So it seems like they, in some cases, are doing a pretty good job of maintaining their own privacy. And I guess where I'm going with this is maybe the public needs a Freedom of Information Act disclosure to protect some of their rights. I wondered if you had any comment on that.
I think that's actually a very clever idea. I think that a good shortcut for accomplishing exactly the kind of thing that you're talking about is for the United States, most likely through federal legislation, but possibly through other means as well, should adopt the opt-in approach to personal information as opposed to the opt-out approach. Obviously, you can't necessarily have an opt-in approach with respect to information that we need to give the government, for instance, residency and, you know, driver's license information, tax information, and stuff like that. But particularly with respect to corporations, which is ultimately where I think the bigger immediate threat lies, the fact that the American system basically puts the onus on individuals to affirmatively go to whatever corporation they're dealing with, and all of us deal with dozens and dozens of businesses and corporations over the course of a day or a week, and to specifically request that their information either not be collected or not be distributed beyond the specific purposes for which it's collected. And that, I think, is really backwards, because we have a system now where people whose lives are, you know, incredibly busy as it is, are now forced to micromanage, if you will, every step that their information travels. And I think that we need to start treating, on a national level, we need to start treating information as the valuable commodity that it is. And so as individuals, we shouldn't be deprived of that control over the information without a clear and specific exchange for value. So I think if we were more along the lines of the European model, which definitely requires a opt-in approach before information can be distributed, would be in a much better position.
Well, that sounds great. I mean, I'll hang up, but I just was wondering, is there any legislative activity moving that idea? So, thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Thank you. I, to be honest with you, I am not aware of any that has moved. If it's even been introduced, I doubt it has moved past that level. I know some of the folks who work on privacy down in Washington, and even with the Democrats in charge, this is not an idea that has gotten a lot of traction yet.
Let's take another call, a listener in Champaign on line two. Good afternoon.
Hi, good afternoon. I have a question for your guest about airport security, and forgive me if you addressed this earlier in your show. It seems to me that there's something inherently troubling about the full-body scanners that, you know, they can see with enough detail that they have to blur your face. in order to protect your privacy, yet it still feels very invasive. I guess what I don't understand is why this bothers me, and I was hoping your guests could maybe talk about maybe the legal traditions or why this gets to our, hits close to home.
That's a wonderful question, and let me just as a brief aside mention that I did a post on this a little while ago for the Beacon Broadside blog, which is the blog that Beacon Press runs for its authors, and certainly people can look that up. It's kind of fun. The issue, I think, is precisely the way you phrased it. It is close to home. It's about as close to home as you can get, because when you look at the images that are generated by the full-body scanners, the level of detail is remarkable. And certainly Homeland Security and the TSA has talked until they're blue in the face about all of the different measures that they've taken to prevent individuals from being identified or to protect the privacy of individuals who go through the full-body scanners. But you're completely right to be somewhat skeptical about that. The Electronic Privacy Information Center, filed a Freedom of Information Act, as a matter of fact, and got some documents from TSA that indicated that the ability to save the images had not been fully disabled, as TSA had said it had been. And the simple truth is that, was it 27-odd years ago, Stuart Brand, who is the publisher of the Whole Earth Catalog and a guru in the computer industry, said information wants to be free. And at the time, he was making an economic argument that the distributive cost of information was rapidly falling to zero. Since that time, though, it's taken on this broader sense that information almost has an organic quality, which is to say that if you create information in electronic form in particular, your ability to control the spread of that information is challenged. It's very difficult to do. And so I think anybody who sees the situation is right to have a somewhat skeptical attitude that those images will not wind up somewhere where they shouldn't be at some point. And as a matter of fact, there have been a couple of European legislators who have argued that the images are so clear that if you're under the age of 18, they essentially constitute child pornography. So you raise some very difficult legal issues with respect to that. Now, the TSA rejoinder will be, well, the person at the controls can't actually see the individual going through the scanner. There's blurring of the, private bits, et cetera, et cetera. But I think it bothers us because we have too many examples of videos, Paris Hilton, for instance, or what have you, of videos getting out into the world when they're not supposed to. And I think that's a legitimate concern.
Yeah. Does the caller want to follow up?
No, thank you very much.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. That idea of information being an organism is very interesting because we do talk about, we use the word viral.
Mm-hmm. That's a good point, Celeste. That's exactly right. And I hadn't actually made that connection, but I shan't forget it now.
Yeah.
and that's the perfect analogy. I think that, we are living in this incredibly dynamic time, and the benefits of information sharing and the ease of distribution are tremendous. I mean, I chair the school board up here in Burlington, and we're in such a better position in terms of communicating with our constituents. At the same time, however, we have not really developed the societal norms for the handling of information in the electronic era. Back when everything was on paper, it was a lot simpler. We knew what was private. You didn't take your parents' letters out and post them all over town or something like that. It's a very different dynamic, and I think we're still sorting out what the appropriate boundaries are. And that's why I actually make the argument that if you had some sort of agency that was in charge of creating standards of behavior, not only for government and corporations, but also educating the public as well, would all be better off.
Yeah. It's interesting. You mentioned your parents' letters or your grandparents' letters. You might have taken them out and shared them with a couple of friends, but that's as far as it went.
Right. And you would have made a very conscious decision about who you could have trusted that information to. See, that's the thing. when, you know, for instance, I post something on Facebook or I post something on Twitter, I have to make that calculation ahead of time in a sense that I need to only post things I don't mind spreading, because I have to build in the assumption that they will. And that will be interesting to see how that plays out, if we will get less cavalier, if you will, about what we put out there, because we know we can't control it.
Yeah. And a tweet is forever.
That's right.
It's scary to think of, because, you know, sometimes it's something important that is communicated, and sometimes it's just very trivial.
That's right. Yeah, well, I think of all of those poor songbirds that are losing their environment. And unfortunately for them, tweets are not forever. But for us, yes, indeed. And, you know, I think that for me, the history piece of all of this is fascinating, because as much as we revel in what we have today, Facebook and Twitter and so on and so forth, I really do believe that it's important and it's valuable to see the history of how we got here. And to my mind, a good chunk of that story is the relationship between the citizenry and the government. And what makes all of this more difficult, you were mentioning at the very beginning that government is monitoring Facebook, it's monitoring Twitter and so on and so forth. I mean, obviously, listeners should be aware that corporations are way ahead of the government in terms of what they're monitoring. Most of the Fortune 1000 companies, for instance, have people whose sole job it is to compare applications to social networking sites, you know, to see whether or not there's some indication that the individual that they're planning on interviewing or they're considering has some sort of behavioral problem that they don't want to bring into the company. I often lecture to kids at universities and colleges and so forth, and routinely I will download photos from various social networking sites used by kids in the college to show them what people are looking at. You know, kids face down in the snow, kids chugging bottles of Jack Daniels, things like this. And those are basically side by side or an appendix to whatever application they're sending out. You know, so we talk a lot about the government, and I think historically that is incredibly important, because obviously the life, liberty, and deprivation of happiness if the government chooses. But much more significant is, what are we doing to our job prospects, our relationships, what have you, by what we're putting out there.
Author and attorney Frederick Lane is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. He is the author of American Privacy, the 400-year history of our most contested right. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join the conversation this afternoon with a phone call, 333-9455, 800-222-9455, or by email, will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, let's talk a little bit about history and American privacy. I thought this was very fascinating, given today our concerns about privacy and security that go side by side.
Mm-hmm.
The story of the controversy surrounding telegrams and the U.S. mail in the years leading up to the Civil War and then during the war. Tell us about that.
Well, that's a great story, because it involves certainly one of our national heroes, Abraham Lincoln. And as I was researching this and looking at the relationship between technology and privacy, you know, the Civil War was a natural place to focus, because the telegraph was effectively introduced in the 1840s or so, and by the Civil War was probably the main it was the main form of rapid communication around the country. And I was startled to be reminded, I guess, or to really appreciate how threatened Washington, D.C. was when Abraham Lincoln took office. He actually felt that there was an imminent threat within weeks of his being sworn in that the Capitol would fall, that it would come under assault. And so in an example that, you know, resonates today, he ordered federal agents to go around to area telegraph offices and seize all of the telegraph copies that were in those offices to see if there was any indication or any planning of efforts to take the Capitol. And try as I might, I couldn't find any local news coverage of that. It was not a time, I think, when civil liberties were at their fullest flower. And maybe it's a good thing when we look at our own time today and we look at the uproar that occurred when it was discovered that the NSA was essentially reading every email and every web communication going through the trunk lines in San Francisco. Maybe it's a good thing that we're more sensitive to these things now than we certainly were back then. But I was not terribly surprised. I think that if you look at World War One, when we had the so-called Black Chamber, which was an offshoot of the Secret Service then, and they were basically doing a similar thing, except they were going to the telegraph companies and saying, we want all of your foreign communications because we're going to use them for our code-breaking efforts to understand, you know, what kind of military threats we're facing overseas. But there was no, quote-unquote, legal right for them to demand those. They basically said to the telegraph companies, if you want to be seen as a good citizen or if you want to help the war effort, you will give us copies of every foreign transmission. So, again, that brings us back to the debate of security versus privacy. Was that a legitimate thing to do? The fact that they were simply foreign telegrams at least makes the argument, much like the NSA does today, that it's perfectly okay to listen to foreign communications of one kind or another. The issue gets cloudier, I think significantly so, when the government is listening without warrant to domestic conversations. And I hope that we will get some sense coming out of this that that's not okay, but I'm concerned that that statement has not been clearly made yet.
Let's take another call, a listener in Champaign, on line one. Hi.
Morning. Good afternoon, I'm sorry. I was struck by a couple of things. One was that these days you try to be like, I try to position myself politically somewhere between being a terrorist and being, like, terrified. But what I was thinking in terms of the, like, cultural dissonance-wise, I mean, the Islamic culture is a very strong tradition about female modesty, and so does ours, for that matter, in a way. But the idea that you couldn't come to this country without having your wife or yourself, for that matter, or your any kin, totally revealed that way is sort of appalling in a way, isn't it?
Well, I mean, the word appalling, of course, has a lot of meaning to it. But I think that, yeah, there are definitely going to be cultures that are extremely uncomfortable with the idea that their spouses or themselves are being viewed by someone, even if that individual can't see them. Sure, absolutely.
And this is one of the aspects of things. Well, thank you very much for the program. Very, very topical. Bye.
And I want to also go back a little bit in history. You talk about the postcard. Privacy concerns were also raised with the advent of the postcard. And while we love our Facebook and our Twitter, people really loved postcards when they first came out.
Well, and still do, honestly.
Sure.
Although not to that same extent. I'm actually a bit of a postcard collector, so this was something that I found particularly interesting. And, yeah, I think you could argue that they were the Facebook or Twitter of their day. They weren't in the sense that they were being plastered to a global audience.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a little bit different than that. But certainly, if you were writing down your thoughts on the back of a card and sending it out unsealed, you never knew who was going to read it. I mean, you had to assume that every once in a while a bored letter carrier or someone in the sorting office was going to read what you had written. And I think for the most part, the contents of postcards reflected that in the sense that what is written on there is not terribly, quote-unquote, private, as we would know it today, or as we might commonly assume that word to mean. But at the same time, you know, if you read enough postcards, you will find some very personal statements on those cards. I mean, protestations of love, descriptions of illness, tragedy in a family, that kind of thing. Not things that in the early 1900s people were necessarily comfortable speaking publicly about. But somehow there was a bit of, as we say, magical thinking that the card would only be read by the person to whom it was sent, when of course that wasn't true. And some of the things that I quote in my book are very kind of sarcastic commentaries about the fact that, people have this illusion, but in fact, lots of great sport is being had over what is written on these cards.
Yeah. Has Congress recognized a right to privacy in legislation?
Not explicitly. No, I don't think so. I think that if you look at the various laws that I talk about in the book, you know, some of the banking laws, the Electronic Privacy Protection Act, a few things like that, there are definitely instances in which Congress has reached out and said, you know, we recognize that there is this value in American society, privacy, and that different aspects of it should be protected. One of the things I think that was particularly dismaying about the Patriot Act is that when you really look at what that law did, it was almost as if it was targeted at all of the things that had been passed by Congress over 30 years to protect privacy. So even those protections that were adopted, particularly in the wake of Watergate and then going forward over the years, even with those, much of what they accomplished was rolled back by the Patriot Act. So it is a fair question, is a fair answer to your question to say that Congress has never explicitly recognized that. And more importantly, the nods that they've given to it in various pieces of legislation lost a lot of their effect back in 2001.
Let's take another call. A listener in Effingham, line one. Hi.
Yes, thank you for taking me. I understand the concern about the Patriot Act, and I realize that I live in a small, rather benign community, and we do have still paper ballots, which we mark, and there is a paper trail. But I found the first caller, some of that, a bit over the top. I have family living in the metropolitan area of St. Louis, and I know there are cameras, multiple. I thought the listening devices was a bit much. I also thought the only one candidate permitted on the ballot, that seemed a bit much, too, because it seems to me that occurs anywhere where either party or the third party or whomever chooses not to run a candidate against the incumbent. And I also think that part of the problem is Americans have become so addicted to the Internet and so addicted to the use of credit cards and allowed their local papers to, in essence, die. I believe your professor the other day told David Inge 1,000 journalists a month nationwide are losing their jobs, whereas local reporting is the best key to stop corruption, and major investigating reporting from newspapers that once had foreign bureaus is dying. I think Americans need to take hold of their own what the essence of their participation in what's going on, but not overreact. I'm simply not afraid of listening devices. Maybe I'm too boring a citizen, but and I've voted for too many years not to understand the concept of just one possible candidate. Thank you for listening. I'll listen to your answer offline.
Thanks for the call.
Well, I think that was a very, very perceptive comment because as you flip through the book, it should be very clear to people that I do agree that we all have a responsibility to try to set boundaries on what information is distributed out into the world and to pay attention to what we feel should be private and to hopefully look for candidates or encourage candidates who value privacy as well, particularly in the sense that I'm using it, the ability to choose and control what happens to our information. The point that your caller made about the role of credit cards, I think, is particularly valuable because I devote a couple of chapters in the book to looking at really the history of the growth of credit cards, which combined with the growth of computers is primarily responsible, I think, for the huge amount of information that is generated by consumers every day. And without those two innovations, we would be in a much different place vis-a-vis the whole privacy issue than we are now. And, you know, think about the number of times that we use a debit card or a credit card during the course of the day. Every single one of those is a date-stamped, place-located piece of information about what we've done, which gets back to my earlier point about the profile of ourselves that we create through our activities and whether corporations down the road will tailor their request to that profile and thereby unwittingly or even wittingly deprive us of choices that we might conceivably be interested in.
Yeah, it's very interesting. A couple of months back, I got a call from my bank And the woman said, I'm calling from such and such a bank, and I want to know, have you been buying gasoline in Texas? And on the one hand, I was pleased that they had caught fraud.
Yes.
On the other hand, I thought, they know everything that I buy.
That is a good reminder. That's exactly true, Celeste. Yep. I had a conversation along these lines with an attorney I was working with the other day, and he was startled at the rapidity with which it happened because he had a similar experience. Somebody had made a relatively minor purchase at a, I think it was a Walmart or a Best Buy across the country, and within literally 2 minutes of the purchase, his phone rang, and the credit card company said, did you make this purchase in, you know, Sacramento or whatever? And he said no, and he too was glad, but I think it was a little daunting that it was that quick.
Yeah. There, we've got to leave it. We're out of time. Frederick Lane, thank you so much for talking with us this afternoon.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Frederick Lane is the author most recently of American Privacy, the 400-year history of our most contested right. The book is published by the Beacon Press.